You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, millions of people around the world live in urban slums without basic services like electricity or running water. We'll talk to a Wisconsin author who spent 7 years following two resilient women living in one of Central America's poorest neighborhoods. First, Republican State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald introduced a new bill earlier this week that calls for the creation of a new Office of Alcohol Beverages Enforcement that would be attached to the State Department of Revenue. Critics say the bill would create an alcohol czar. Here's Senator Fitzgerald.
Everyone agrees the enforcement has just fallen apart. There's just nothing there. So this bill will put some teeth back into that.
Jason Stein is a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, good to be on. Thank you.
Well, Jason, when people hear alcohol and enforcement, they're thinking maybe, oh, alcohol sales to minors or drunk driving. This has nothing to do with any of that, right? It's the system by which alcohol gets made, distributed, and sold in Wisconsin. How do things work right now?
We have a system called the three-tier system that goes back to the Depression. Even thinking about it makes your head hurt. It's very complicated. But basically what it says is if you make alcohol, you can't retail it. You have to sell it to a wholesaler. The wholesaler sells it to a retailer, either a bar or, you know, a retail store. And that is only then does the consumer get his or her hands on it.
And is it seen that one of those groups has some kind of advantage over the others in the current system?
Well, I mean, everybody has opportunities to make money. I mean, look, I think what happens is the system right now both sort of limits what businesses can do in terms of making money, but it also creates some opportunities, right? If you have a wholesale business and you have sort of cornered a certain market, you know, selling alcoholic beverages to retailers, you know, you don't want to see people that are making alcohol, you know, selling it necessarily directly to consumers or selling it to retailers, right? Because that's booze that you're not involved in, you know, so to speak.
And that's there's a lot of blurred areas now. If I have a small brewery and I sell it on site, can I do that? If I do that, can I sell it at the liquor store down the road but not beyond? There's a lot of people pushing the envelope a little bit on that three-tier system, right?
I mean, that's the allegation being made. You know, I mean, Senator Fitzgerald says that everyone agrees that the current system, the current enforcement has fallen apart. I mean, I don't think everyone does agree with that. I mean, certainly Miller Coors, which is a pretty, you know, I think knows the beer business pretty well. They argue that the current system is working reasonably well. But certainly, I mean, there are, you know, certain businesses have certain exemptions to do certain things and other businesses don't and would like to get them. And so there's a lot of friction going back and forth. Because obviously, you know, especially if you're like a small brewer or distiller, it may be difficult for you to get a wholesaler when you start out and you don't have much volume. And then you're kind of stuck, right? Because you can't, it may be hard for you to sell it yourself, but you can't get a wholesaler necessarily to buy it. So then how do you get big, you know, how do you grow your business?
Talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about proposed changes to enforcement of laws about how alcohol gets distributed. And Jason, let's get into the specifics. What would Senator Fitzgerald's bill do?
So it'd do two main things. One is create something that, you know, has been sort of described derisively as an alcohol czar. This would be a person who'd be a political appointee of the governor, and it would confirmed by the state Senate, who would have police powers to sort of enforce this three-tier system and make sure that alcohol is being sold and distributed lawfully in the state. So that's the first part.
And the second part?
The second part would have to do with a business that the Kohler company, sort of the American resort, has selling chocolate brandy. They want to expand that business. I gather it's been reasonably successful. They would like to be able to both, you know, sell that on site and sell it in some other ways. One of the challenges you have that typically when a business gets an exemption to sell their product on site, you know, with some sort of tasting shop, then it can mess up their ability under state law to serve other types of alcoholic beverages, which if you're running a restaurant and a resort, you know, you really need to be able to do that. So they're wanting, you know, an exemption, a carve out in the state law to be able to do all those things, which I don't think anyone is objecting to that on its own. But there are lots of other people that want that and don't necessarily want to see the problem be resolved on a case by case basis. They want a broader solution.
So with the main part of this bill, this new alcohol czar, again, as critics are calling it, what's been the reaction in the legislature?
It's varied. You know, I wouldn't say it's been a broad acceptance. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said today that he does not see that bill passing in its current form out of his house. Governor Walker has also had reservations about it. In the Senate, obviously, it's being proposed by Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, and so it has more juice there. But even there, the committee chairman who has that bill told me just an hour ago that he wasn't sure he had the votes to get it out of his committee. So, you know, right now it seems like it's going to fail, but obviously it's seemed to die in the past and then come back to life. So we can't totally count it out.
And there's a public hearing, I understand, at the Capitol earlier today. What kind of things came out of that?
Well, obviously, you know, there have been, from distributor groups, there's been some complaints, wholesaler groups, that the law hasn't been followed. You know, I've tried to follow up on that. So far, I haven't really gotten a lot of, you know, concrete examples of really, you know, sort of eye-opening abuses. Really haven't gotten those yet, although I'm asking about them. And then again, you've just seen small-scale beer brewers, liquor distillers, that are a pretty fast-growing business in the state, many of them objecting to this, saying that they didn't have a chance to weigh in enough and are, you know, concerned that this may in some way impede their businesses in the future.
So they are against this. MillerCoors, you mentioned, against it. Who is lobbying in favor of this?
Well, again, I mean, I think, you know, most of the push for this seems to have come from wholesalers, as far as I can tell. Obviously, they hired as a lobbyist the former speaker, Jeff Fitzgerald, whose brother to Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, a few weeks ago, around the time that this bill seemed to pick up steam again. Senator Fitzgerald told me today that his brother, you know, hasn't had undue influence on the bill, but he wouldn't really get into, beyond saying they talked about it, wouldn't say how much they discussed it or how often.
Is there a sense that even if this bill doesn't pass, that that there's some appetite for a change or at least tweaks in the three-tiered system of alcohol distribution?
Oh, I think there's a vast appetite for changes. I think the problem is, like many things at the state capitol, different people want different changes. And, you know, what is good for what a, you know, a small brewer in southwestern Wisconsin sees as good for him, a beer wholesaler in Milwaukee may see as very bad for him. So I think that's been the impediment to change. I mean, this is something where you've seen this for at least 10 years in the state capitol, where typically changes try to be made quickly and, you know, without a lot of transparency. But they do typically also fail because people get mobilized very quickly because their businesses depend on it.
We'll leave it there for now. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us to talk about Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald's proposed bill that would tighten up enforcement of alcohol production and sales in the state under our three-tiered system. We've got some news items on this at WPR.org. If you have a stake in this or a Stein in this, let us know what you think about these proposed changes while you're there. By 2050, an estimated one-third of the world's population is likely to be living in urban slums without basic services like electricity, running water, and trash disposal. The people living in those communities are often the hardest hit by things like climate change and economic downturns. Our next guest spent 7 years following two women and their families in the Nicaraguan city of Managua. Their stories are the basis of his new book that aims to put a face on the poverty that millions of people live with every day. Douglas Haynes is an associate professor of English at UW Oshkosh. He's the author of Every Day We Live is the Future, Surviving in a City of Disasters. Douglas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, before we meet the families you followed in Managua, let's follow you. What led you, a guy from Wisconsin, to Managua to visit this slum?
Right. So I am a writer, a nonfiction writer, and do what's called literary journalism. And I try to tell stories of big global issues, particularly environmental justice issues, from the bottom up. So telling those stories from looking at people's firsthand experiences. And I had been reporting in Latin America over a number of years, lived in Guatemala for a while in 2004, and had the opportunity to go back with students to Nicaragua in 2008, and connected with a nonprofit organization there that was hosting me and my students. And that's where I met Diane and Yadira in this community, the Widows, or Las Viudas, in Managua, where this organization that I was partnering with works.
And listening here in Wisconsin, we might think of a neighborhood in Nicaragua as very far, very distant. So a theme that comes up through your book is there are a lot of threads that tie the United States to this place and others like it around the world.
Absolutely. So historically, Nicaragua's fate has very much over the last 150 years or so been intertwined with U.S. intervention in Nicaragua. Nicaragua was occupied by the U.S. Marines a couple of times in the early 20th century. And then, of course, more to affect the characters in this book, the Contra War during the 1980s had a big impact on people moving from the countryside into the city. And that's true in a number of places in Latin America and around the world, that political violence is one of the big forces that drives people in this massive global migration, what I would really call a revolution on the planet, from the countryside into the city. And so the Contra War sort of destabilized people's lives in the countryside to a great deal. And in fact, about 40% of Managua's population migrated to Managua in the 1980s and early 1990s.
But something as mundane as to us as the change in the price of fresh fruit means, oh, maybe I won't get that today at the supermarket. That means that one of the people you profile doesn't buy a necessity that night.
Absolutely. So one of the things, big stories that I try to tell in this book is the influence of disasters. And they don't have to be big disasters that get a lot of headlines in the media, but small disasters and the cumulative effects of small disasters. And one of those cumulative effects is food insecurity. And that affects people particularly in urban areas, because they are so dependent, if they're living on the economic margins already, they are so dependent on having just enough money to buy just what they need to feed their families. So if you have something like a major drought, which happened over the past few years, or a lot of unusually intense rains that wipe out farmers' crops in the countryside, suddenly those prices go skyrocketing up and people can't buy the rice and beans that they need to feed their families. Or if you're a vendor, like Diane, one of the women I follow in this story, who's has a fruit and drink stand in a place called the Eastern Market or Mercado Oriental in Managua. She can't then buy enough of the fruit that she buys wholesale to sell at her stand without raising her prices. And if she's in this quandary, she raises her prices, then she can count on the fact of not selling more and her income takes a direct hit.
Well, let's zoom in closer now and meet Diane and Yadira. Tell
sure.
us a little bit about them.
So Diane grew up in a very kind of a world apart from Managua, even though it was only about 20 miles away on the slope of a volcano, an active volcano. And her family wound up there directly as a result of the Contra War in the 1980s. They were being pushed around from place to place and got stuck there during the war. And they were just kind of scrapping to survive. And like a lot of rural people in that area, developed this connection with this growing marketplace in the city of Managua as the city grew. And her mother, Diane's mother, Carmen, started bringing firewood to the market. And she would go early in the morning, really the middle of the night, get a bus with a whole load of firewood, sell the firewood, and then come back home. But gradually, she started realizing this was too much, this process of going back and forth. And she met up with a wholesaler. And a lot of what happens with people when they get to the city is they just take advantage of personal connections that they make. And that's what she did. And this wholesaler convinced her, well, you could make a lot more more money buying fruit in the middle of this massive market and selling it kind of on the outskirts where people are coming in and leaving. And to give you a sense of just how big this market is, I mean, it's grown massively and devoured all kinds of neighborhoods over the years. At this stage, it's about the size of 55 super Walmarts. So it's a huge, huge place that is Central America's biggest marketplace, commercial center, and has drawn people from the countryside from all over the country and actually draws people from all over Central America for commerce. So Diane followed eventually her mother to this market after third grade, when all of Carmen's children were big enough to help her out in the city in this fruit selling business. She brought them from the countryside into the city, and they were homeless for a number of years, just living on the streets of the market. This family kind of camped out under the awning of a pool hall every night until the market authorities saw them and gave them a spot to build a little shanty. And so Diane then herself got drawn into selling fruit and eventually set up her own fruit and drink stand with the help of a microloan, which she had access to through an organization that does microloans for single women, which is one way that can help really people, and particularly single women in this situation, start a business and create some kind of livelihood for themselves. So I look at her story, and then I look also at her neighbor Yadira's story. And Yadira comes from farther away, up near the Nicaraguan border with Honduras, deep in the mountains, where the Contra War really flared up in the 1980s and drove people directly out of the countryside into nearby cities. And a series of family crises pushed her then away from home there through a series of stops, finally winding up with her partner, Henry, in Managua, also squatting, being homeless, and trying to find and invent a way to make a living in this city. And that's part of the story I try to tell in the book. It's really the amazing ingenuity that people like Diane and Yadira have in terms of making a living in what's often called the informal economy.
Talking to Douglas Haynes, a Wisconsin writer. His book is Every Day We Live is the Future, Surviving in a City of Disasters. Douglas, the word precarious comes to my head as I read through your book. No matter how entrepreneurial these two are, and they are, and resourceful, and they are, one little thing, a small disaster that we might not even see as a disaster, a disease, an abusive spouse or partner, so many things. There's so many little things. They're right on the edge of a personal disaster.
Absolutely. And that could be, an economic disaster for the family. It could be, as you mentioned, a health issue, both of which the families in this book have struggled with. And that's one of the reasons that drew me in part to telling their stories. They both have children who suffered very serious illnesses, and that contributed to their difficulties trying to get out of poverty, try to get out of that precariousness in their situation and trying to reinvent their lives in the city. But as you say, one of the things that's really important about this story is learning that, of course, this is not just about Diane and Yadira, but millions of people around the world who are susceptible, living on the margins economically and environmentally in the places where they live, who are susceptible to what I call the sum of small disasters. It could be an hours-long rain. I tell this story of a landslide that happened in Managua in 2014 that really was just an hours-long, really intense rain. But if you're living in the wrong place at the wrong time, below that slope that has been deforested or has a big wall built on it to build a middle-class subdivision, as was the case with this landslide, then you are in a tremendously precarious situation. And their stories, Diane's and Yadira's stories, really show that accumulation of small disasters, but also the intense vulnerability, whether it be through something like food insecurity or climate disasters. Nicaragua in Central America is one of the most vulnerable regions to climate change in the world. And as those climate disasters accelerate, people are facing even more and more precariousness.
Now, here in the U.S., if we think about someone in a, say, Central American slum We probably don't, but if we do, it's probably a statistic. X number of people died in this hurricane, mm-hmm. or so many people are suffering from a disease in this place, or whatever, a big number. Why was it important for you to focus in and put a face on some of the people that behind these numbers?
Well, like I said, since we often hear these stories, the headlines about hurricanes or disasters, or you might hear headlines about global urbanization. You know, it's forecast that by 2030, an area the size of South Africa will be covered by cities. So we're talking about a trend that's really resurfacing the planet. And we're talking about people, of course. A third of people, the UN projects, of humanity will be living in informal settlements or squatter communities by 2050 as urbanization progresses. So I think it's really, really important that we get beyond those numbers and really see what that means for people in their day-to-day lives, and not only the challenges that they confront and the ways that those challenges tell us about how well our societies and our economies are working or not working. I see them as kind of the barometers for the global economy, but also they preview for us trends and issues that more and more of us are going to be facing in the future as these trends of inequality and climate change and urbanization converge. And again, not just in the global South, but here in the United States too, as we saw this past fall in Houston with low-income communities really bearing the brunt of the hurricane there, or in Puerto Rico, for example. These are not faraway problems, and I think we have a lot to learn by looking at the lives of people who are already suffering from them, these problems, in the ways that they adapt and are resilient.
Douglas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Douglas Haines is an associate professor of English at UW Oshkosh. He's the author of the book Every Day We Live Is the Future, Surviving in a City of Disasters. Now, as the nation grapples with an ongoing opioid crisis, there are plenty of questions to be answered as to how we got here and what the lasting impact might be on communities, our country, even our economy. That last point is where our next guest comes in. In a new report, he lays out the economic costs of the ongoing opioid epidemic. The report finds that the economic costs have exceeded $1 trillion from 2001 to 2017, and that dollar figure could grow significantly higher by 2020 if no action is taken. Corey Ryan is a senior analyst with Alterum's Sustainable Health Spending Strategies Program, where he studies trends in health spending, prices, and employment. Corey, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thanks for having me on.
Corey, we've heard a lot of different stories and angles on this opioid problem. Why was it important to try to calculate this economic hit that we're taking from it?
Yeah, I think that's a really important perspective for us to get to take, because what we believe is that you really can't solve a problem until you understand it. And so what we're really trying to do here is we're trying to parse out not only what the total burden is of this epidemic, but also where those costs are coming from, and then where they're falling. And so by doing this analysis, what we find is that productivity losses and healthcare costs are the primary drivers of the opioid epidemic, and the burden that that is placing on individuals, the private sector, and federal, state, and local governments. And so what we see is that those costs are occurring both from fatal overdoses and also from those that are suffering from substance use disorders. And so the combination of those impacts, in 2016, we found an estimate of over $95 billion. And as you mentioned, when we look over the time period from 2001 all the way through 2017, we're talking about $1 trillion in total economic impacts. And then projecting forward, if we see the current rates that we've observed in the past couple of years, we're predicting a potential of an additional $500 billion in total economic costs. And so those burdens are really important for us to try and capture and really try to wrap our arms around the scope and scale of this problem.
Before we dig deeper into what's behind those costs, anything we do about the opioid epidemic, a lot of it looks expensive on paper. When you stack it up, though, against the cost that you're seeing, does it give a little more impetus to take action?
Absolutely. When you're looking at the scale of the burden that we're showing here, I would agree that certainly offering full treatment and recovery services to individuals can be expensive, but it's something that when you're bringing people from a substance use disorder and back to a productive lifestyle and back to being employed and back to being full members of society, it certainly has the potential to be cost-saving. And I think that's a really important message to show. And although we haven't in this work thus far been able to show what the particular intervention kind of cost-benefit outcomes might be, when you look at the total burden that we're seeing, there's a great potential to see cost savings by making policy improvements.
You mentioned a big part of that $1 trillion cost from the opioid epidemic comes from fatalities, from people dying often of overdoses. Can you talk about, obviously outside the human cost, can you talk about how that affects the economy as a whole?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you look at 2016, the CDC estimates over 42,000 deaths across the United States as a result of opioid fatal overdoses. And what is really striking about those deaths is that over time we've actually seen that the average age of those fatalities has gone down, which indicates that we're losing people right in the prime of their life. These are when they have young families. These are when they're expected to be employed and expected to be earning wages. And so by then trying to look, okay, what is the impact that this individual would have had they not suffered that overdose, had they not been addicted to opioids originally, and what would their life course have looked like? And they would have been earning income, they would have been supporting a family, they would have been paying taxes both at the federal, state, and local level, and that's really where the bulk of these economic costs are coming from.
Talking to Corey Ryan from the group Alterum, and he's with the Sustainable Health Spending Strategies Program, talking about a new report on the costs, the economic costs of the opioid epidemic, $1 trillion over the last 16 years or so in costs that report finds. And Corey, another aspect that you mentioned, healthcare, rising, increased healthcare costs due to opioid addiction. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so there are two main components that we capture in this report, and in some ways they're just kind of the floor of what the potential healthcare costs might be. So the first component is healthcare costs associated with overdoses, and so that's primarily individuals that are going to the emergency room as a result of an overdose. They're getting treated, they're getting saved, and then they're also potentially then being hospitalized as well as a result of those overdoses. So that's one component. The second component are what we call indirect healthcare costs. So this is the indirect risk of being a opioid user that puts you at risk for other diseases. So those that use opioids, and particularly those that use illicit drugs, are at a greater risk for HIV and hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and also just makes treating their other medical conditions so much more complicated if they're also suffering from a substance use disorder. And those costs are borne both by private insurance, by Medicaid, and by Medicare. So it's relatively evenly split across those payers.
Something we've heard anecdotally here, I don't know how widespread this is, but we hear in Wisconsin that employers sometimes have a hard time finding employees who can pass drug tests, in part because of opioid use. Is that part of the cost you see?
That's absolutely a major issue. It is something that is captured here. Because of the way that we measure the economic costs, the combination of individual costs and employer costs are rolled together as lost potential wages, because those are benefits that are kind of combined to both the individual and what they're getting paid, but then also the productivity that they're offering to their employer. But that story is something that we have also heard across the country, and certainly makes it difficult for employers to expand, and is extremely frustrating when they're looking to, in this in some ways booming economy, to try and expand their reach, and they can't find the people they need to make that happen.
When you pull this all together and get that $1 trillion figure, and as you say, another maybe $500 billion in the coming years, those are big numbers. But you know, it might take the form of this county over here is having to pay more for Narcan and emergency response personnel, and the economy as a whole is taking a hit, but you might not feel it individually. Are these costs so dispersed that it's hard to realize how big a deal it is all at once?
So the costs certainly are not evenly distributed across the country. We know that there are hotspots both of users and also of death, and certainly of direct impacts on the private sector. So that is certainly an issue. And you're right. I think part of the problem when you're trying to marshal resources towards solving this problem is that it's not just the federal government that's bearing this cost burden. It's not just state and local governments. It's not just the private sector. So it's really hard to find that one key investor that's willing to put all the necessary funds forward in order to solve this problem, because so many diverse groups are being impacted. And so as much as we can get groups to realize that they need to be able to pool their resources and work together to solve this problem, that's going to be our most effective strategy to finding solutions.
We're talking about the economic costs of the nation's opioid crisis. Our guest is Corey Ryan, senior analyst with Alterum's Sustainable Health Spending Strategies Program, where he studies trends in health spending, prices, and employment. Their new report there says Hey, the economic costs $1 trillion since 2001. 2001 to 2017. More expenses to come if this goes on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has the opioid epidemic taken a toll on your town, your city, your local government, your local economy? How do you see that playing out? If you are in local government, are you seeing rising costs related to opioid addiction, to heroin overdose? What do you think governments can do to try to rein in the costs? And if you're an employer, are you in that situation where you need to somebody who can pass that drug test, you're having a hard time finding them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We'll go to a caller. James is on the line in Appleton. James, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Great topic you have going on here. I was just calling to say that I work in the health field in the Fox Valley area in an ER, and I see on, you know, a weekly basis, sometimes day to day, the problems with opioid abuse that can happen and how much it's costing everyone involved. And I was just wondering, you know, you have this, you did this research, you have these numbers for the opioid abuse from 2001 to 2017. I was wondering, with all across the country how states are decriminalizing marijuana, I was wondering if you had any numbers against what that is, so you could, we could kind of quell the viewpoints on people to say that that's just as bad as the opioid abuse is happening. And I could take my response up here.
James, thanks for the call. Corey, I know this report focused on opioids. I don't know if you have anything comparable on marijuana. Throw that in if you do. But to start with this point about seeing this in ERs, that is a big part of the cost here, right?
Yes, absolutely it is. That certainly is the most direct way that individuals that suffer from overdoses get pulled into the healthcare system. And unfortunately, that's often a point that it's far too late for us to be intervening. It would be far better to encourage prevention and treatment efforts before those overdoses occur and before the fatalities occur, because that's a much more cost-effective way to solve this problem. And it takes a wide variety of stakeholders to be engaged in those activities. It's both looking to employers, it's looking to leaders within the communities to really engage individuals in preventing opioid use as much as possible. And certainly that also means turning to looking at the medical community and certainly improving prescribing practices and limiting the number of opioids that are going towards treating chronic pain, which we know is not a successful strategy.
And that takes us into some of the recommendations in your report. I know you mentioned you didn't do kind of cost benefit of the different solutions here, but what kind of recommendations are you coming out of this report with?
Right. Yes. So I think looking at particular interventions and strategies is certainly something that we want to do down the road. And this is really the first step to saying, okay, what might the cost benefit analysis be of a certain program? And once we have a better understanding of what options are being employed and we have better data that comes from around the country as these interventions are being put into place, we should be able to develop some of that work. But the recommendations that we're making right now really are revolving around three different categories. One, as I talked about, is efforts to prevent opioid addiction before it happens. And some of that is involved with certainly interventions that need to be done in the community, law enforcement strategies to get illicit drugs off the streets as much as possible. But it takes so much more than that to solve this problem. And really, we need to look to the medical community to improve how we treat chronic pain, offering alternatives to individuals, and doing a better job of cutting down on unnecessary opioid prescriptions. So that's preventing the unnecessary substance use on the front end. But then we also need to take advantage of the opportunities to treat those that are suffering from a substance use disorder. And so what that really means is that it's getting them into detox services, getting them medication-assisted treatment as early as possible, and then also engaging them for long-term steps towards recovery. And that really means engaging an individual through a long-term plan, because we know that it's not just a two-week detox program that's going to get somebody through their opioid addiction. It's going to be a long-term combination of resources that they need over a long period of time to get them to recovery.
I want to bring on another caller now. Vince is with us in Milwaukee. Vince, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about
this? So, yeah, I'm a heroin addict. I've been through treatment multiple times. I tried the Suboxone, which kept me clean until my insurance ran out and I was no longer to get my prescription anymore. because I can pay for it. And I tried also an inpatient treatment center two times, which the first time worked out. I stayed clean for about 12 months. The second time I got kicked out for using about a month into it. I overdosed one time, and in my vehicle, the paramedics came and gave me Narcan, and then took me to the hospital, which I wasn't able to pay my hospital bill either. I didn't have any money. So I'm trying to actually get into methadone treatment right now. I called 2 days back, and they said that they should be calling me back after they screen my background. So I'm hoping that this will work.
Vince, thank you for sharing your story. Good luck to you. Keep plugging away, and I hope you find a good treatment that works for you. Corey, talk about this. He ended one of his treatments because he couldn't afford it anymore. Looking at your report and the costs, is that a case to be made for? It would have been worth it to keep Vince to pay for Vince's treatment and not deal with the other problems down the road.
Yes, absolutely. When patients have something that's working for them, taking it away from them can certainly lead to bad outcomes, and that's absolutely something that we want to prevent. And again, like I've said, it takes partnerships with many stakeholders in order to make that happen, because it's not always going to be one provider or one source of funds that's going to make that happen. But as much as we can keep folks like that are on a path towards success moving in that direction, that's really what we want to try and promote.
Vince, again, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. Corey, briefly, as we wrap up, I assume this report you're hoping is a wake-up call. Do you see people responding in that way?
Yes, absolutely. I think, as I said, you know, the goal of doing this type of work is trying to understand the problem, but also absolutely try to draw attention to it and try to marshal resources towards it, because this is a problem that's going to take funds, and it's going to take investments in prevention and treatment services to cut down on the number of deaths, which we still see rising through 2017. We don't have 2018 data yet, but every indication is that this problem is still getting worse, and unless if we can get the resources that we need to start and chip away, this problem is going to get worse. So hopefully it draws attention and hopefully it starts getting people thinking about what we can do about it.
Corey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Corey Ryan, senior analyst with Alterum Sustainable Health Spending Strategies Program, where he studies trends in health spending, prices, and employment. He just joined us to talk about the group's new report on the economic cost of the nation's opioid crisis. A bill has passed the Wisconsin State Assembly that sets minimum safety standards for old barns that have been repurposed to hold weddings and other events. But as Glenn Moberg reports, some local officials worry that the new state regulations won't go far enough.
The wedding barn bill was introduced by State Representative Travis Tranel, a Republican dairy farmer from southwestern Wisconsin. He says his bill focuses on safety.
Proper egress, you can't have open flames within the building, no smoking within the building, fire alarms, the flashing ones, so everyone is aware if there is an incident. Everything has to be to the current electrical code. The plumbing all has to be up to code.
Tranel says uniform standards are necessary for a growing industry.
Ag tourism is definitely a growing thing. People are looking for any and all excuses that they can to get out and enjoy rural Wisconsin.
Imagine having your wedding and reception in one of Wisconsin's most unique settings.
The wedding barn business is booming. From high-profile sites like Old World Wisconsin, managed by the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Within our centerpiece facility, the Clausing Barn.
To rustic, unregulated old barns owned by family entrepreneurs. State Representative Katrina Shankland, a Democrat from Stevens Point, says she supports Tranel's bill, but thinks it could be improved.
It seems like the laws haven't been keeping up with the growing trend toward agritourism, and I'm very supportive of agritourism. I think it helps people in rural communities with economic development, but I do think we also need to balance those needs with safety.
So we need your help, Katrina. Well,
Shankland spoke at a meeting on safety that drew rural town and county leaders to a wedding barn owned by John Aaron, the head of the Portage County Farm Bureau.
We want to make sure they're safe.
Aaron says he put $500,000 into his barn, including safety features that go above and beyond what's required by Tranel's bill.
His backup lights and generator made a difference during a wedding reception in August after a semi-truck hit a freight train in Stevens Point.
And all of a sudden, the power went out everywhere in the barn. All the neighbors were completely dark. Instantly, all the backup emergency lighting kicked on. People were still going in and out of the bathrooms. The emergency backup generator fired up.
Aaron says backup lighting and generators should be required.
I look at what would have happened. You know, everybody has some alcohol, and all of a sudden, it's completely black in here. Somebody's going to trip down the stairs, or worse yet, get trampled.
We get the government we deserve.
Aaron invited Nancy Mistel, the director of Wisconsin's Office of Business Development, to tell the local officials what they could and couldn't do. She said they need to accommodate the wedding barn business when they can.
If you're a town that simply says, ain't going to happen here, and if you do it, we're going to fine you $500 every time you do it, I've got people that just consider that a cost of doing business.
Trucks are going up and down the road, squealing their tires.
The town leaders had concerns about too much noise in residential neighborhoods, parking on the highway, and safety. Barry Jakowski is the Portage County Planning and Zoning Committee chair.
I would hate to have friends or my family members go to something like a wedding or an anniversary that is supposed to be a very joyous occasion and lose the whole family because the barn went up in flames.
Leif Erickson, a Town of Eau Plaine supervisor, said some barns could collapse.
And I worry about having dances in these buildings because they're not built for that. They're built for dead weight. Hay, grain, whatever, that's what they're built for. They're not designed or built for moving weight.
Erickson said some barn owners hold weddings without getting permits. He said they ignore safety regulations and then claim that their events are private and only for friends and family.
People have barns and have a barn dance once a year. That's not a problem. But when people are generating income and avoiding taxes, that's what bothers me more than anything else.
Nancy Mistel says there are things town and county officials can do. They have the power to issue temporary seasonal permits for wedding barns and set conditions for them.
My advice is sit down, work with people, and see what you can come up with, because two heads working together are probably going to come to solutions.
The wedding barn bill has not yet passed the Wisconsin State Senate. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at proposed changes to food stamps in the president's budget released earlier this week. Those plans include a move towards sending a box of selected food items to replace some of the financial assistance. We'll get the details and ask what you think about the idea. We'll explore the weird economics of ticket sales for concerts and sporting events. Our guest economist says, hey, a lot of those tickets are underpriced, even though they may seem pretty expensive. And on Food Friday, our own Lori Skelton is back with us for some great advice and new twists on making delicious soup to keep us warm for the last weeks of winter. You can share your favorite soups. What do you like to make? What do you like to eat? And any questions you have on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow after 6, join Kate for a Wisconsin weekend look at community theater around the state. And you can share your experience as a community theater fan, actor, or crew member. That's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the suspect in the deadly school shooting in Florida yesterday had ties to a right-wing white nationalist group. We'll talk to an expert about extremism in the United States. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.